Mark Hamrick is the senior economic analyst at Bankrate.com. Hi, Mark. Welcome back. How are you?
Oh, always good, and always good to be with you. Thank you.
We've been talking a little bit on and off in the news and otherwise about the president's speech last night. One of the things he mentioned was late fees for delinquent credit card payments, and he said that those should be capped and lowered instead of, you know, close to $30, under $10. What are you hearing about that? What do you think about that?
Sure. Obviously, President up for re-election. This was essentially, I would say, teed up a few days earlier when the Consumer Financial Protection Board had taken this action, seeking to make it a rule, essentially not through legislation, but through rulemaking, to put this out for public comment and then essentially have it take effect. What's happened in recent days is that a host of groups, whether they're trade groups, et cetera, have announced that they are going to fight this in court. So what I would say is that, you know, if you're out there listening right now, I understand that no one is a fan of paying elevated late fees for credit card payments or interest that is due. And if you have a choice of paying 8 or 32 under what begins to be a less than optimal situation, you'll say, well, if I have to pay one or the other, I'll take the 8.
Yeah.
The industry is not ready to take this sitting down, though. And so what I would say, much the same as the president announcing student loan forgiveness sort of through rulemaking that was challenged in court and lost, don't count your chickens before they're hatched here on this.
Well, to be honest with you, you can tell that my wife pays the bills. I don't know if we've been delinquent on a credit card payment any time lately, but it would seem to me like if you're already getting over 20% interest on the amount I owe, if I didn't pay my bill on time, you should send me a thank you note, not a $28 bill. I mean, seriously, Mark, what? Harm have we caused the banks? I guess I answer that question. What harm have we caused the banks if we're delinquent in our payment on a credit card bill?
Well, first of all, you're right to the extent that the banks are looking to make sure that they don't face, let's say, an undue problem themselves with somebody who essentially fails to pay at all. And that's essentially what they're concerned about. And there is no doubt a component of this that is profit making, right? And that's essentially what the regulators are pointing to and saying they're excessive. And in the political environment we're in, we'll have, you know, the phrase greedy corporations creeping into this, I'll say, sometimes hypercharged rhetorical environment. But the other part of it is that people take credit cards to use them as a tool for better and for worse. And sometimes it is for worse when we're talking about an average credit card rate that is still at 20.75% and higher for people who have lower credit scores or poorer records paying their bills on time. What I would say, though, that, you know, for people listening, whether they have a dog in this fight or not, we would urge them to try not to accrue credit card debt to the point that they're not paying it off before the billing cycle kicks in. Because like any other tool, like a hammer, you can use it to build a house or you can use it to hammer your thumb to the point of injury. And we don't want to use these tools where they're hurting us.
Well, not to belabor the obvious here, but if somebody is in difficult enough financial straits that they can't pay their bill on time, hitting them with not only 25% interest on the card and then a $30 fee seems to be trying to get blood out of a turnip. The reason I didn't pay on time is because I don't have money. Now you're going to ask for more money, and it's going to make it that much more difficult for me to give you any money. I mean, that's just a cycle that goes the wrong direction, Mark.
No, agreed. Agreed. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, but again, this is not necessarily a done deal one way or the other. And so I think right now it's sort of existing mostly in the political environment and now it's going to move to the judicial environment.
Talk to me about the jobs report, Mark.
This one was a complicated one, John, because there was a lot going on within it. And essentially in this world where some people choose to either pay attention to the facts or make up their own narratives that may or may not be based on the facts, there's kind of something here for everybody. And what I mean by that is, first of all, you know, traditionally, let's say from the Main Street perspective, the headline is the unemployment rate, and that is 3.9%, a little higher, the highest since January of 22. Let's think about the fact that the unemployment rate had moved to 3.4%, which was the lowest matching recently, but also at that point was the lowest basically in about 50 years. So we're coming off of those low levels. It was up 0.2%. But then the payrolls, the number of jobs added, were much stronger than expected, 275,000 jobs added. And then to undermine that just a bit, the previous 2 months were revised lower by 167,000. So instead of that January number that we might have talked about at 353,000 jobs added, that got chopped way back to 229,000. So the takeaway is that I think we're getting back to a normal economy now, sort of getting away from the pandemic. So it's moderation, it's normalization. Interest rates are high, and I think this is in the context of what the Federal Reserve will be looking at as we get into the middle of the year, and they'll be saying, you know what, the economy's kind of cooling off a little bit here. It's not freezing, but it's definitely cooling, and it's time to begin to reduce some of these interest rates.
I thought I saw somewhere income. Is income moving up? What's the rate on that? Do you have that handy?
Yeah. Sure. Average hourly earnings are one of the sort of siblings among the many children or data points in this report. And average hourly earnings are up 4.3% year over year, and the January reading 4.5%, but largely because of the 22 states that raised their minimum wages in January. This isn't a 4.3% wage increase that everybody's getting, we don't think, based on this data set anyway.
Well, I wonder, is that inflationary too?
No, we don't think so. And if anything, workers are just sort of recapturing sort of the benefit in so-called real wages or wages adjusted for inflation, having, you know, suffered the slings and arrows of losing 20% of their buying power through inflation going back to early 2020. So it's a little like being robbed by inflation on the sidewalk at gunpoint, obviously not violent to that extent. But now you've sort of been robbed and walking away, and now you're picking up a $5 bill. So, you know, nobody's getting rich off of these wage increases. They're only beginning to claw back some of the benefit that they would have enjoyed had we not had this inflation.
I was wondering if an uptick in unemployment might cause the Fed to be slightly more aggressive on the interest rate side.
Well, in terms of moving lower, possibly, yeah. But yeah. Their forecast is 4.1% unemployment by the end of the year. So they could be looking at this and saying, you know, we don't want to make too much out of 1 month's numbers. We've had some up and down in the unemployment rate in recent months as well. But they'll say that the economy is holding up quite well and has been much more resilient and robust than would have been expected, especially after the steep rate hikes going back to early 22. And thinking about the fact that over the past 2 years, John, you know, economists of all kinds were saying the risks of recession were extremely elevated. Now those risks are still out there, but they're not seen as elevated as much as they were before, let's say, over the next 12 months or so.
What do you think is going to happen at the next meeting of the Fed?
Well, it'll be an interesting one. I plan to be in that room when Chairman Powell walks out. And obviously, the expectation is that there's not going to be any rate move at that meeting. The most important thing that'll come out of that, and of course, we had congressional testimony from him this week, where they were basically saying they think they can afford to be patient with respect to those rate cuts, meaning the economy's holding in there. But they also don't want to have so much restriction as to cause the economy to essentially go into a contraction. The most important thing that we'll take away from this meeting, for those of us that pay a lot of attention to it, is that we will get essentially a new set of economic projections from the Fed, which will tell us essentially individually, all the voting members and members of the FOMC, where they think rates will be over the foreseeable future. It also includes their forecasts for growth, for unemployment, for their preferred measure of inflation. And so we'll have a better idea of what is sort of going on in their heads. And from that, we can distill where we think rates are going. But right now, the expectation is we get lower rates beginning in the summer and continuing on through the end of the year.
Last time I set a line on interest rates, the over-under, I had it at 3.5. Then I moved it at 2.5. But I'm going to set it back at 3.5. Do you take the under on that rate reductions this year by the Fed?
Well, if you mean where they will end up by the end of the year from their benchmark rate, which is the federal funds rate, which is currently between 5.25 and 5.5.
I'm talking about the number of reductions.
Okay. Yeah. Well, number would be probably right now a baseline of about 3 cuts, which are all 25 basis points or 1/4 of 1%. So that would be essentially a reduction of 75 basis points or 3/4 of 1%.
Right. You'll take the under.
By the end of the year.
You're taking the
I
under.
Guess so. I guess so. If it's my mother-in-law's money, I'll take the bet.
One other number I want you to comment on. More than a third of us have more credit card debt than emergency savings. Can you give me a little context or perspective on that?
Yes, this is our survey that my colleague Greg McBride works on, and this is one we do every year. And so now that we have 36% of Americans with more credit card debt than emergency savings, that's the highest that we've found as we've been surveying on this question alone since 2011. And it's within the context also of our broader studies of emergency savings, which you can read about at bankrate.com, where we find that only 44% of Americans can pay an emergency expense of $1,000 or more from savings. So credit card interest rates being high, people carrying more debt and occasionally paying those fees that we talked about earlier if they're not paying on time, and still trying to dig out from the inflation damage that incurred, you know, over the previous years. So this is our call to action for people to try to prioritize emergency savings. The good news is here that 55% of adults have more emergency savings than credit card debt, and that's actually the highest since 2018. And furthermore, and you probably even have advertisers who are raising their hands on this, John, now is the time to take advantage of the most generous returns on savings, whether it's a CD,
high yield,
all those things. 4% and 5% are easy to get with, and they're easy to find.
Sounds like you just continue to describe the K-shaped economy we have, and that's Mark Hamrick, Senior Economic Analyst, Washington Bureau Chief at Bankrate.com. Always a pleasure, Mark. Thank you, sir.
My pleasure, John. Thanks for having me. Have a great weekend.
We did not ask Mark Hamrick from Bankrate about the rates on ETFs for Bitcoin. He probably could have talked a little bit about that. You may have been hearing the news that the Security and Exchange Commission has approved ETFs, Bitcoin ETFs, including from companies like Fidelity. And so the value of Bitcoin goes up to record highs now. To talk a little bit about it is Emily Stewart, who writes about this at businessinsider.com. Hi, Emily. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So did I steal your headline there? That was the that was the reason for this?
Yeah, that's the long and short of the reason. At the beginning of the year, the SEC kind of gave its begrudged blessing to spot Bitcoin ETFs, which are investment vehicles that track the price of Bitcoin as it goes up and down. And that has really contributed a lot to Bitcoin's rise in prices over the past couple of weeks. We've seen Bitcoin's price hit a new all-time high just this week. And I think, again, today, I mean, today is very recently.
Yeah, I know. We're at 69,000. I thought we may have touched 70,000 in the last few days, but I may be wrong about that. But you would have to then go back to 2021, right, to see these kinds of prices. So what does that tell us about Bitcoin over the last 3 years? It's been stagnant, huh?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, and this is sort of what my story gets at, we've seen Bitcoin go up and down and up and down and up and down basically since it's been around for the entirety of its existence, for over a decade. So if you, and it maybe has not been this high, but you back to 2013, 2017, 2021, Bitcoin has had some real meteoric rises. And then we've also seen some declines. If you think about what happened after 2021, it was in the teens for quite some time. So this is a new development in the Bitcoin cycle. Is the story going to be different this time? It's hard to say. When Bitcoin hit that new high on Tuesday, it almost immediately declined by about 70%. So Bitcoin is a risky asset, and it's bouncy.
What's the advantage to a Bitcoin ETF?
You know, a Bitcoin ETF, if you do want to get some exposure to cryptocurrency, it feels safer. It feels more familiar for a lot of investors. You know, if you think about just investing directly in Bitcoin, if you go on an exchange and you leave the money on the exchange, you know, they're saying that if it's not in your wallet, it's not yours. So if it's not your exchange, it's not your coin. So what we saw happen with, let's say, an FTX a couple of years ago, is that a lot of people had left their money, Bitcoin, what have you, on the exchange. The exchange goes under, poof, your money is gone. And even if you read the fine print of a Coinbase, they say, listen, if we go bankrupt, we go under, your Bitcoin is gone. And it's hard to hold on to it yourself. You can lose it. I think a lot of people have heard those horror stories. And so with an ETF, people invest in S&P 500 ETF. So this is a lot safer mechanism to get some exposure without, you know, risking that you wake up one day and your Bitcoin is just poof gone.
So instead of picking a Bitcoin like a mutual fund, you invest in a product that is spread across a bunch of these Bitcoins, these cryptocurrencies, and it sort of insulates you from maybe the rise and fall of one of them, right?
Well, this only does track Bitcoin. It's not tracking other cryptocurrencies. So yeah, I think that is where it looks like maybe the SEC might look at something on Ethereum. But a lot of these cryptocurrencies, I mean, the vast majority of them are pretty risky assets that don't do anything at all. Like, I don't know if in the future there is a Dogecoin ETF. I don't know if that's going to happen.
Well, you alluded to the horror stories of people losing Bitcoin. I think I know what you're talking about, but why don't you clarify? What was that all about?
Well, the thing with Bitcoin, and this has happened to me before, years ago, I had money on an exchange that the government shut down. And because I wasn't holding the Bitcoin in a digital wallet, my money was gone. And you also hear stories of people like, let's say I did have my money in a digital wallet, but then I left it on a hard drive and I forgot and I threw that hard drive away. Or I lost the little key that identified my Bitcoin and it's gone. And so there are a lot of ways to lose Bitcoin and to lose track of it, or, you know, to be robbed of it, right? You hear of all of these stories of people being scammed for a lot of their cryptocurrency. That's not going to happen in an ETF. You buy a Bitcoin ETF, you maybe get the BlackRock one, and it's in your portfolio, just like your stocks and your mutual funds and everything else.
I've heard of people who have lost their keys or their passcodes to get at their Bitcoin or their cryptocurrency, and maybe it was on their hard drive and they can't find it. And if you have enough unsuccessful attempts, you're locked out forever, and they don't have their money. It's out there in ones and O's, but they can't get to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think in 2013, I invested in Litecoin. I left it on an exchange again. And now every once in a while, I figure out how much money I'd have. And I think I put $100 in, it would probably have $10,000 that I would very much like to see. And there's absolutely no way for me to ever get it back. And so I think, you know, with this ETF, that's not going to happen. And I think there's quite a bit of appeal there.
There's a great story out there about somebody who lost hundreds of millions of dollars that way. His then wife threw out the hard drive that had the information on there. It's in a city dump somewhere, and he cannot find it. So what is the expectations of Bitcoin? If we're at 69,000, 70,000, are they projecting it? Where do they think it's going to go, Emily?
I mean, you can find a lot of really optimistic predictions out here. There are forecasters who will say it's headed to $100,000, $200,000, $500,000. You also have predictions saying in April it's going to go to $40,000. I think if there's any sort of takeaway for me on cryptocurrencies and on Bitcoin is that it's really, really difficult to predict. You know, I talked to one really kind of expert in Bitcoin who's really a Bitcoin believer, and he said, you know, he thinks that these ETFs kind of signify, for Bitcoin specifically, the asset being kind of more mature. He thinks that hopefully Bitcoin won't be as volatile going forward because these ETFs are going to be buying the Bitcoin, putting a little bit of a floor under it. It kind of remains to be seen whether that's the case. I think it's also worth noting that a lot of people didn't think these ETFs were going to take off as much as they had. I talked to an analyst at Bloomberg who said, you know, we kind of thought this might look like the first gold ETF that launched in 2004 that was really hot at first and then kind of died off and just, you know, kind of boiled over the years. And these have really had some sustained interest for investors, you know, millions and millions of dollars flowing into them daily for 6 weeks, 2 months, I guess, basically. So, you know, Bitcoin, it does feel like it's a little more mature now, especially with these ETFs. That being said, I think the line on crypto is always, you know, it's really volatile, and I don't think we have a lot of evidence to show that history won't repeat itself in some way, shape, or form with a lot of these cryptocurrencies.
Well, how should I contemplate Bitcoin or these cryptocurrencies more like commodities than equities on one of the stock exchanges? It's not like it has some sort of fundamental value based on the performance of a company, say. It's just a commodity that rises and falls based on demand. I'm just thinking out loud here. I'm trying to figure out how these things, how the value of these things goes up and down, Emily.
Yeah, well, the CFTC does have jurisdiction over most cryptocurrencies, although I think the SEC every once in a while looks over and says, gee, that looks a lot more like a security or an equity than any of you would like to say here. So there's plenty of debate about that, even among regulators. But yeah, I think this is better to think of as a commodity. And I think it's also important to, you know, remember with people that most of the time it doesn't really serve a purpose. You know, what Bitcoin people will tell you is that it's money that isn't controlled by a government, and and there is some appeal to that, but it's not like it's really doing anything, and it's not really a currency either. I mean, you think back to 10 years ago where people thought, oh, you can buy coffee with a Bitcoin or a pizza with a Bitcoin. And, you know, if you bought a pizza with a Bitcoin 10 years ago, you probably have some regrets because that Bitcoin is worth a lot more than that pizza.
Exactly. You know, I don't know if they're still out there, but we were doing commercials for Bitcoin ATMs around here where you could get cash or put cash in. And I don't know if that was a convenience or an investment machine, but and I haven't heard of them. But it does seem silly to maybe buy a cup of coffee with a Bitcoin, which a couple of years from now might quintuple in value, right?
Right. Yeah. I think at this point it would be pretty risky to try and use it as a currency. I mean, God bless if that's what you'd like to do, but I might not use it that way. I know the ATMs are still around some places. I read about one recently, but yeah, I think with cryptocurrencies, it is, you know, a lot of it is just ultimately speculation, just like in a lot of markets.
Yeah.
And I think it's not much more than that. And I think sometimes, you know, you think back to 2 years ago, we're going to build all these things on these different platforms and Ethereum and you know, NFTs. We don't hear about that stuff. And at least this time, I do think the run is a little bit different in that this is really ultimately about people making money and speculating, and nobody's pretending like it's anything different.
Well, and as you said, it's the Securities and Exchange Commission blessing it, however begrudgingly. Emily Stewart writes about this at businessinsider.com. She's a senior correspondent there. Nice to talk to you today, Emily. Thanks for your help.
Thank you.
More business news on the Wintrust Business Lunch with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. The Centers for Disease Control has awarded $14 million to Chicago health company Habit New. It's a 5-year agreement that will allow Habit New to implement a national network connecting diabetes prevention program providers with people who need services. One of the goals of the initiative is to recruit people from populations at risk for type 2 diabetes. The focus will be on Black, Hispanic, and urban communities. Type 2 diabetes affects marginalized communities disproportionately, and 1 out of 3 Americans is at risk of developing type 2 diabetes. A DePaul University funding group that focuses on startups has made 2 new investments. The DePaul Halperin Emerging Company Fund has awarded $100,000 each to AlphaThena and Mooski Snacks. AlphaThena is an artificial intelligence-powered investment firm. Mooski Snacks makes fresh granola bars. AlphaThena is based in Warrenville. Mooski started in California but has ties to Chicago. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
If you eat food, this may be of interest to you. We call it The Business of Food with Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you. It's International Women's Day, and if there is a woman in your life who is serving internationally in the U.S. military, she may love this. Jerky.
Yes, right. It's called Jerky for Troops.
More about Jerky for Troops and how you can volunteer and help out after I thank the Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com for sponsoring us today. There's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. There's never been a better time to put some jerky in a box and send it to a member of our military serving overseas.
Jerky for the Troops started about 20 years ago now. to appreciate the people in service.
That is Dale Berg. He's commander of the VFW post in Arlington Heights. He's also a member of the Northwest Town Sportsman Club, which is where the jerky comes from, hunters who donate their venison.
Yes, it's all donated. We take it, we grind it up ourselves.
Well, hunting season is over, and it's time to make jerky.
Original flavored jerky, teriyaki, hot and spicy, sweet and spicy. We also make one called prime rib.
Dale, who served in Vietnam, knows what it's like to get a care package from home.
Well, I tell you, it means a lot. You don't feel like sometimes that you're supported by the population back home.
And along with jerky, the boxes are packed with other goodies.
Personal hygiene items, razors, foot powder, chapstick, shampoo, dental floss.
And?
Protein bars, granola bars, sunflower seeds, nuts, instant soups, ramen noodles, candy, gum.
And?
Stationery, envelopes, travel games.
Plus?
Great schools have written up cards and letters expressing the support.
And the women and men on the receiving end don't just get one box.
They get four or five, maybe six boxes. And for a short period of time, they're the king and the queen of their unit.
Here's how you can help. Dale says volunteers are needed to pack the boxes.
Anybody can help, and it's nice. They come in and box all the stuff up and put labels on them.
Okay, where do they go and when?
American Legion Post 208, 121 North Douglas Avenue in Arlington Heights.
11 o'clock in the morning on Saturday the 16th is when they start packing boxes. There will be free jerky samples for volunteers. Again, that's Saturday the 16th, 11 a.m.
Yes.
And cash donations are welcome, too.
Yes. Actually, we have never had a dime left over.
Thank you, Dale.
It was nice talking to you.
Jerky for Troops in Arlington Heights. On the food calendar, it's National Peanut Cluster Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Here in Chicago, St. Patrick's Day is kind of a doings, you know. And they've got some interesting activities coming up at Old St. Pat's Church. Mark Skozafave is the Director of Music Ministries for Old St. Pat's, and he joins us on WGN. Hi, Mark.
Hi there.
I am not sure how to pronounce S-I-A-M-S-A.
Shimsa. Shimsa Nagel.
And tell us what that is.
That is a word that describes a celebration of Celtic arts, and that's what we call our concert that we're hosting on Monday, March 11th at 7:30 at Symphony Center.
Tell me a little bit about that. What's that like?
It's a celebration of Celtic arts through music and dance and anchored in story, and it presents a honoring of the Celtic arts in a way that is really beautiful. We have a narrator, Terry Hemmert, is going to guide us through the story. The story is anchored
on
of course. The story is anchored on St. Brigid, and we have dancers, we have pipes and drums, we have wonderful soloists, and of course the old St. Patrick's Concert Choir.
I see. So this is going to be Monday, March, that's this coming Monday at 7:30, and I understand there's 400 tickets left. I can still get a ticket to this show?
Tickets are available at cso.org or by calling the box office.
Now, there's other activities or events you have planned on March 16th. I'm looking at Shamrockin'. Can you tell me about that?
Shamrockin' begins on March 16th. It's between 11 and 5 a.m. It's a sold-out event, although there are some tickets available at the door. And this is hosted on our campus and features pipes and drums, Whiskey Mick, Liam Durkin, other dance groups. It's fun for the whole family with food and Irish fare to enjoy.
Let's go back to Shamsa, I believe is how I pronounce that. Do that again?
You got it. You got it. Shamsa.
I'm not going to try it again then. And this is the 25th anniversary, is that right?
That's correct. It started, founded by Maggie Daly and Shirley Ryan 25 years ago, 1996. This is the first one. And so we're happy to bring it back. This is the first time we've been back in Symphony Center for this since the pandemic.
Is it what I would describe as Irish music? It'll sound and look like that?
It'll sound and feel like Irish music, Irish dance. There's some contemporary dance elements to it as well. And video, it's all the senses are available here. It's going to be a great show.
And you're assembling all this? Is this your sort of artistic creation this year?
I've inherited this, and it's my first time doing it, and I'm humbled and grateful to do it along with my colleague Dominic, and it's going to be great.
Good luck to you on this. It's at cso.org or call the box office 312-294-3000. Mark, good luck to you on that.
Thank you very much. Good to talk to you.